Hello and welcome to Spider on the Web number 92. I'm Spider Robinson, and this is Moe Scarlett jamming with the late great Jeff Healey in Toronto in 2005. Take it, Moe's.
I'll be down to get you in a taxi. Better be ready about 8:30. Oh, baby, don't be late. I want to be there when the band starts playing. Remember when we get there, honey? Two steps, I'm going to have them all. I'm going to dance out both of my shoes when they play those Jelly Roll Blues tomorrow night at the Docktown Strutters Ball. I'll be down to get you in a taxi, honey. Be ready about 8:30. No, baby, don't be late. Gonna be right there when Mr. Moe starts playing. Remember when we get there, baby. Two steps, I'm gonna have them all. Dance off both my shoes when they play the Jelly Roll Blues tomorrow night, the Docktown Strutters Ball.
Oh, yeah, take it.
Remember when we get there, honey, two steps, I'm gonna have them all. I'm gonna dance out both of my shoes when they play those Jelly Roll Blues tomorrow night at the Docktown Strutters Ball. Yeah, I'm gonna dance out both of my shoes when they play those Jelly Roll Blues tomorrow night at the Docktown Strutters. Don't forget what to tell your mother tomorrow night at the Docktown Strutters Ball.
At regular intervals, I find myself standing in the hair care aisle in the pharmacy, staring helplessly at all the shampoos, trying to guess which one I want. At least I'm smart enough to know I don't want the one that advertises it's, quote, like a blast of hydration to your scalp, unquote. That means it's the same thing as pouring water on your head. Why not just use real water? It's way cheaper. Unless you insist on organic water. I'm pretty sure I want some form of Pert Plus, because that one has conditioner mixed right in with it, making it, at least as far as I know, the only conditioner you can buy that does not look exactly like semen. I like saving an entire step in the hair washing process, and especially if it means I don't have to artificially inseminate my scalp. But there are many varieties of Pert Plus, each identified only by a cryptic word or two, none of which ever seems to quite apply to my particular hair. Jeannie used to buy a variety that always worked perfectly for me, but not only do I forget which one, I have a strong suspicion they stopped making that kind. Nothing there on the shelf looks right. So I stand there in the aisle, slack-jawed, a baboon examining a shelf of library books, looking for the good one.
"Volumizer," says this one.
Do I want my hair to have volume? I guess so. I mean, I don't want a perm, but who doesn't look good with more hair? If your hair doesn't have volume, it's two-dimensional, Mr. A-Square.
"For dry hair,"
says that one. Is my hair dry? Sure. You know, when it isn't wet. Is your hair dry when it's wet, buddy?
"For curly hair,"
offers another one. To make my hair curlier, you mean? Or to make it less curly? And which would I prefer? My hair's a little curly. How much is just right?
"Deep down,"
I'm not even going to try and guess what the frack that means. But no, I don't think I care to go deep down, fella. You're not getting in the shower with me.
Moisturizer.
Do I want moist hair? Then why do I own a hairdryer? Sooner or later, I make a decision as to which of these is, well, not most accurate, but at least inaccurate, and I buy it and take it home. And sometimes it seems to make my hair look good, and sometimes it seems to make it look like shit, just like all the others. But today, Pert finally hit my sweet spot. It called to me from the shelf in the pharmacy. At last, someone understands my personal style needs. Grocks my unique esoteric follicular requirements, supplies all I ask of hair goop. The label says it all.
Classic Clean.
For normal hair. I bought two bottles just to help make sure the new format succeeds. And I used it tonight, and you know what? My hair is clean, by God. And normal looking. Speaking of clean, normal-looking hair, by the way, I just learned that Sir Paul McCartney will be coming to Vancouver for the first time since he was a Beatle to play the BC Play Stadium the day after I turn 64. I don't plan to go. It's way too much hassle from out here on my island, and the good seats go for $250, but it's pretty cool he's coming anyway. They say he's a very clean old man. No, wait, I'm thinking of his grandfather. I'm back, my friends, and before we get to either the fiction or more music, I want to say how much I appreciate the kind patience with which so many of you have continued to send donations during the long recent podcast drought. You warm my heart, and I'm glad I'm back with y'all. There's been a lot of stuff going on, standing around in pharmacy aisles, for example. For another, I led a 10-day workshop at the prestigious and venerable Sage Hill Experience in a Franciscan monastery in Lumsden, Saskatchewan, where I met and worked and played with five talented SF writers I predict you'll be hearing more of soon, these being in alphabetical order, Gillian Bell, Robert Dawson, Douglas Schmidt, Holly Schofield, and Sarah Shoker. I also met some new lifelong friends among Canada's established authors, including Kimmy Beach, who has an entire book of poems inspired by Paul McCartney called Fake Paul, Commonwealth Writers Prize winner for the Book of Negroes, Lawrence Hill, Harborfront Festival Prize-winning novelist and poet Helen Humphreys, Giller Prize finalist John Gould, whose novel Seven Good Reasons Not to Be Good I tremendously enjoyed, John Valant, I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, whose first book, The Golden Spruce, won the Governor General's Award for Nonfiction, multiple award-winning poet Ken Babstock, and another multiple award-winning poet Sue Goyette from Halifax, my former home. For another thing, I've just completed reading and recording my own novel, The Free Lunch, for Blackstone Audio. Look for it a few months down the line. I think I should insist on a producer credit, too. I mean, I had to find a copy of the book and make sure the talent showed up in the studio on time, sober, and turn the lights out after everyone else left. I couldn't have done it without me. Anyway, I'll give you a sample of The Free Lunch a little later on in this podcast. But I also have a complete and really sweet story I think you'll enjoy, written and read by an old friend. But enough talk of past and future. Let's press on to now. Here are Kathy Guthrie and Amy Nelson, ukulelists and singer-songwriters who record under the name Folk Uke, with a relationship song I hope you'll enjoy from their splendid self-titled first album.
Power. shit makes the flowers grow. I wondered why you're here, but now I know. Shit makes the flowers grow.
I studied it for 8 years.
Shit makes the flowers grow. Oh, shit makes the flowers grow.
I forgot to mention, by the way, Kathy Guthrie's dad's name is Arlo, and Amy Nelson's dad's name is Willie. Okay, time for some fiction, friends. In my last podcast, I suggested that if there was sufficient interest, I might follow up my reading of the prologue of Seymour Hamilton's Astraea, Book 1, with a second reading of Chapter 1 of that book. When I finally found the time to shovel out all the accumulated email in my website account recently, I found that quite a few of you were eager for more Hamilton. But I just learned that Seymour is planning to tackle his own audiobook of Astraea, much as I just did with my own novel. So I'm out. You should have the privilege of hearing that splendid book for the first time and remembering it forever in its author's own distinctive voice. And to show you that I know what I'm talking about, here is a sample of the man himself, one of my oldest and best friends in Canada, Seymour Hamilton. And instead of just the first chapter of a trilogy, you'll hear him reading a complete story, a fairy story for children and adults, The Littlest Dragon, the first of the related stories collected in Seymour's wonderful new book, The Laughing Princess, copyright 2012 by Seymour Hamilton. The Littlest Dragon.
There came the time in which we now live, when princesses are rarely seen outside picture books, wizards are met only in stories, and dragons eke out a mythical and heraldic existence on shields, flags, badges, and, perhaps, in the minds of those who yearn for a simpler age. Into this rational but anxious time were born two children, a sister and a brother. They were well-fed, well-loved, well-dressed, and well-educated, and they knew that if only their world lasted another lifetime, they would surely acquire a generous share of its goods and pleasures. Their names were Petra and Daniel, and they were both of that special age at which they had discovered that their parents did not always understand them. They had been taken by trains, airplanes, cars, and ships to a little remote village at the foot of great mountains that rose out of a fjord as deep as the peaks were high. They were on holiday, but since neither Petra nor Daniel had been consulted about their destination, they were not overjoyed when they arrived on a rainy day when the clouds clung to the knees of the mountains, the sea mist rose up the cliffs, the pines dripped onto the rocks below, and the stone houses of the village huddled damply together within the constant sound of the surging sea. The next day was no better. While their mother and father exclaimed about unspoiled beauty, traditional architecture, and unchanged folkways, Daniel and Petra were bored by the rain-soaked village that smelled of fish, and wished for the entertainments to which they were used in their city home. The voices of the villagers were slow and slurred in their ears. The children of their own age, who they saw from time to time in the village square, had no attention to spare for tourists, and did not even give the visitors' bright holiday clothes a second glance. The inn at which they stayed was filled with adults, who frowned if Petra and Daniel so much as ran down the stairs, and it was too wet to play outside. When they awoke on the second day, and saw raindrops sliding down the window panes, Petra looked at Daniel, and Daniel looked at Petra, and without a word exchanged between them, they decided to sulk. They tagged along behind their parents, had their photographs taken in front of the ruined castle, their tummies filled with cakes and pastries between meals that left them groaning from overindulgence, and their feet were made sore from walking on cobblestone streets while their parents conducted an implacable search for anything old enough to be picturesque and odd enough to be called quaint. They stared at coats of arms in a museum and saw a bewildering assortment of dragons rendered in ironwork, paint, wood, glass, picture books, and even on needlepoint chairbacks and quilts. Daniel broke their sulking pack to stick out his tongue in imitation of one of the more horrendous dragons, a sea monster holding a girl in its claw, and Petra laughed before she remembered she was trying to maintain a day-long frown. The third day was as bright as the preceding two had been grey and misty. The rain pools dwindled among the cobblestones, the sun warmed the pines so that they perfumed the air, and old men came out of nowhere to sit on bollards and benches at the edge of the quay which formed one side of the village square. Their seamed and wrinkled old faces impassive, they sucked on pipes and stared out of rheumy eyes at the fishing boats, no doubt thinking how much easier it was for today's sailors than it had been when they were young. After breakfast, Petra and Daniel were informed that they were to amuse themselves, a prospect which appealed only slightly less than spending the day feeling seasick on the small and fishy boat which their parents had hired to take them up to the head of the fjord. Feeling abandoned, banished, and rejected, the children sulked and pouted until their faces were sore from keeping air in their cheeks and frowns on their foreheads. A friendly waitress in a blue gingham dress presented them with boxes containing lunch, and told them of a little beach beyond the castle where she had played as a child. They said a polite and insincere thank you, and set off across the square, splashing their feet in the few remaining puddles. Petra and Daniel followed a grassy path along the cliff-top to the seaward side of the ruined castle. Beside the massive granite walls was a flight of broken stone steps that ran from a battlemented tower down over the cliffs to where waves splashed into bright spray against a rocky breakwater. Protected by encircling cliffs and the remains of a stone dock was a little bay edged by a sun-warmed beach. The children soon forgot their ill humor, as the magic of the meeting between land and sea claimed them, and they climbed carefully down the ancient steps, eager to explore. Before long, Petra had a pile of shells that had been curiously shaped and polished by sand and sea water, and also a damp smudge across her forehead, to which her fair hair clung. Daniel's left foot was wet from slipping on a seaweed-covered rock. His curly red hair was filled with sand from trying to see into what might have been a cave in the cliffs, and his pockets clinked and bulged with the smooth stones he had collected. When they sat down to eat their lunches on a piece of granite bigger than a dining-room table, it was only with difficulty that they remembered to complain. "Nothing to do," said Petra, nibbling on a hard-boiled egg.
"Not one solitary thing," agreed Daniel,
around a mouthful of smoked herring.
"Awful," said Petra.
"Dismal," said Daniel.
They finished their shortbread in silence, broken only by the sounds of the sea and the creaking cry of gulls that circled overhead, looking for scraps. Daniel threw his apple into the air, and they watched the birds squabble over it until one particularly large and fierce gull flew with his prize up to the top of the castle's crumbling battlements. "Bet you I can skip a stone 7 times, said Daniel.
"Bet you can't, said Petra.
Daniel managed 5 on his first try, 6 on his second, and then Petra lost interest after a succession of 3s and 4s.
"7, he yelled, and turned to see his sister bent over the shells she had gathered, her hair curtaining her face.
"You never," she said. "I did. It was a beauty. I bet there isn't another skipping stone like it on this beach. In the whole world, maybe."
"Bet there is. You can't find it, that's all," said Petra, and went on arranging her shells into interesting patterns. Daniel started to search for another well-shaped stone. He walked along the edge of the sea where the ripples left salt foam on the sand, and he stepped onto clinking shale that had fallen from the cliffs into the shadows below. Near the cave-like cleft in the rocks that had fascinated him earlier, but into which for some reason he had not wanted to venture, he stumbled and looked down. There was a stone round as a coin, polished as a jewel, smooth as a china saucer. It fitted his hand comfortably, and when he moved into the sun and stroked it with a curious finger, it warmed to his touch.
"I found it," he shouted. "Watch me."
Petra glanced up in time to see Daniel's arm swing back. She looked out at the water to see where the splashes would come, but nothing disturbed the ripples on the little bay.
"Ha!" she said derisively. "You dropped it."
When she looked back at her brother, she saw that he was holding his hands in front of him and staring at them intently. Wondering whether he might have hurt himself, she left her shells and walked to where he stood.
"It spoke to me," murmured Daniel, and then looked at Petra. "How did you do that?"
"What?" asked Petra.
"Make your voice go all hissy and squeaky," said Daniel.
"Don't you dare,"
you said.
"I did not." Daniel shrugged and raised his arm again to throw the stone.
"Throw me in that cold water, and you'll be sorry," said a small voice.
Daniel looked at Petra, and Petra looked at Daniel, and they both stared at the stone in Daniel's hand. The rounded rock swayed back and forth on his palm, then split open. With the sound of a peculiarly strong eggshell breaking, two thin husks of stone fell onto the beach, and in Daniel's hand was a tiny winged creature.
"It's a bug," said Petra.
"I am not a bug," said the small voice. "Insects don't have scales."
"It's a snake," said Daniel.
"I am not a snake," said the voice clearly. "Snakes don't have wings."
"Then what are you?" asked Daniel.
"I'm a dragon." They stared at the little creature, which flexed its emerald green wings, swung its pointed ruby red tail, and opened its mouth to display needle-sharp fangs no bigger than those of a mouse.
"It's beautiful," said Petra.
The dragon nodded.
"I know," it said proudly.
"I'm going to throw it into the sea," said Daniel, who was confused, nervous, and felt the need for decisive action.
"Do that, and all your hair will drop out," said the dragon.
"You will be an old man, just as quickly as I can say the words, and you won't like it a bit."
"Go on," said Daniel. "You're too small to hurt me."
"All right," said the dragon. "I'll give you one more chance. Look up at the top of the castle wall." Daniel and Petra looked up to where the granite blocks of the fortress were a ragged line against the sky. A piece of the battlements twice the size of a chest of drawers turned bright red, flew up into the air, and fell hissing into the water of the little bay where they stood.
"See," said the dragon.
"Any more rude remarks about size? And the next time I'll choose a piece of that mountain over there, and you'll be underneath."
"Would you mind if I sat down?" asked Daniel,
and his knees did it for him before he could get an answer. The little dragon was unaccountably heavier in his hand.
"Are you related to the dragons whose pictures we saw in the museum?" asked Petra.
"I certainly am," said the dragon.
"I'm Petra, and this is Daniel," said Petra.
"I know," said the dragon. "He's the one who put out his tongue at the picture of Kealka Ida and the princess."
"I'm sorry," said Daniel.
"There was a time when you'd have been turned to stone, or transformed into a flounder, or at least given a plague of warts," said the dragon.
"But it's more difficult to do the magic these days.
Steel ships plough the sea, and it's not safe to fly above the treetops. Only the old people give us a thought as if we were legends and dreams. Would you like a piece of my sandwich? Asked Petra. There's still some left. It's nice to see that there is still one fair maiden, said the dragon gallantly. Thank you. I'd like that. Petra offered a piece of ham sandwich, and the dragon took it between two shining claws. Sharp teeth flashed, chewed appreciatively, and the dragon grew longer by the width of Daniel's thumb. May I put you down on this rock? Asked Daniel. You don't happen to have another name such as George or Beowulf by any chance? Asked the dragon. No, said Daniel. And you don't have a sword somewhere? No, said Daniel. Good, said the dragon. I knew it all along, of course, but I was just checking. These days you can't be too careful. Daniel gently lowered his hand, and the dragon walked with dignity to the top of the sunlit rock. It coiled its tail on the stone and stretched its wings with the sound of fine steel being sharpened. Right, said the dragon. Make yourselves comfortable, because I'm going to educate you. Petra and Daniel looked at each other. Oh, no, said the dragon, not your sort of education. None of that foolishness of proving theories or testing hypotheses or learning to juggle imaginary numbers. I'm going to tell you a story.
Oh, good, said Petra. I like stories.
All right, said Daniel, but we won't have to answer questions afterwards, will we? Of course not, said the dragon. Any worthwhile story is complete when it's been told and heard. All you should do is tell it again. Now listen carefully. And as Petra and Daniel leaned forward, the dragon told them the tale of a princess and a sea dragon. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Laughing Princess. The work is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 United States license. The cover art is a photo of Ainulani Kahuwelen, a sea dragon sculpted in ceramic by Pamela Nagley Stevenson, whose dragon sculptures were the inspiration for the stories. To see more of her work, visit PamelaNagleyStevenson.com. The harp music is by Kim Robertson, whose music played as the stories were written. Visit her at kimrobertson.net. To order a physical copy of the book, find out more about Seymour Hamilton, or just chat about writing and books in general, visit thelaughingprincess.com.
Way to go, Seymour. I've known Seymour Hamilton so long he was on the first board of directors of Genie's modern dance company, Nova Dance Theater, back when we lived in Nova Scotia. He and I appeared together in one of her goofier dances, called, if memory serves, Retrocranial Inversion. More music is called for at this juncture. Here is a truly great singer I once had the colossal audacity to sing in front of. He was very kind. You've probably heard his brilliant turn on the theme song of David Simon's great HBO series, Tremé. Here he is with the best version I've heard of Leonard Cohen's much-covered Hallelujah from his tour de force new CD, All About Everything. This is the great John Boutte.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this. The fourth, the fifth, a minor fall, a major lift. The baffled king composing hallelujah. Hallelujah, hallelujah, oh yeah. Your faith was strong, yet you needed proof. You You saw her bathing on the roof, a beauty in the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to a kitchen chair, broke your throne and cut your hair, and through your lips she drew the hallelujah. Time that you let me know what's really going on below, but now you never show that to me, do you? I remember when I moved in you, the holy dog was moving too, and every breath we saw. I've ever learned from love is how to shoot at someone who outdrew you. It's not a cry you hear at night, it's not someone who's seen the light. No, it's a cold. The name in vain. I don't even know the name, but if I did, well, really, what's it to you? There's a blaze of light in every word, and it does not matter what you heard. The holy the broken hallelujah. Wasn't much. I tried to feel, but I could not touch. I told the truth, and I did not come to fool you. Yeah, even though it all went wrong, I'll stand before the Lord of Song.
Hallelujah! Hallelujah! Hallelujah!
Now here's a track that goes out to all the brave young men and women in uniform who are still taking shit and getting hit out there for reasons still not yet entirely clear. It is written and performed by my friend Gail Mead, whom Jeannie and I met on an Alaskan cruise once. In addition to being a great singer-songwriter, Gail is a qualified and highly experienced deep-water submersible vehicle pilot. Accompanying her here on lead guitar and throughout her CD Common Ground is another old and dear friend of mine and one of Canada's greatest living art treasures, the supernatural Amos Garrett. This song is called The War Goes On.
They say we're lucky we live in a country where we're free to march in the streets, but you just might get arrested if they don't like the slogan on your t-shirt. My letters to the editors and the senators fall upon deaf ears. Doing. Go shopping, go to Disney, go to sleep. How quickly we forgot what we were so afraid of losing. How quickly we forgot what it means to be free. My letters to the editors and the senators. And the war goes on, the war goes on, and the war goes on, the war goes on, and the war goes on.
You can sample a lot more of Gail's music at www.gailmead.com. That's G-A-L-E-M-E-A-D.com. I would like, by the way, to give a strong endorsement to what I consider the best music download site on earth, one with a vast selection and way better customer service than the Amazon, the site from which I downloaded John Boutte's All About Everything, and from which you can download Gail Mead's Common Ground if you like that last track. That would be the excellent CDBaby.com. In the several years I've been dealing with them, not only have they always been willing to let me download MP3 albums, even though I'm a lowly Canadian, which mighty Amazon will not do for some reason, but they have always had my back. Once, 2 years ago, I got a bad track from them. I reported it, and less than 10 minutes later, CD Baby emailed me a fixed replacement track. And last night, at about 10 p.m. on a Sunday night, I reported an unsuccessful download attempt, and when I woke up this morning, the problem was already solved and my download went smoothly. CDBaby.com gets my business for life. It's also the best place to find rare Lord Buckley recordings, among many other treasures. And now, a major surprise. It turns out Robert A. Heinlein was wrong. There is such a thing as a free lunch. Well, a free first chapter or two of it anyway. Here now is a sneak preview from the Blackstone audiobook, The Free Lunch, by me. Chapter 1. Going Under. The fourth time was the charm. At around sunset on a Monday, a well-dressed man in his late 40s with a beard and old-fashioned eyeglasses surrendered his bracelet to the attendant and left Dreamworld, unaccompanied by children or other adults. He seemed to float through the exit turnstile, a dreamy smile pasted on his face. He looked, for the moment, much younger than his age. As he reached the edge of the parking lot, near the roped-off area where the evening crowd were lining up for admission, his visual focus distance dropped back from infinity to things as near as the solar system, and he noticed the pastel sunset. It was more than he could bear. He stopped in his tracks, drew in a great belly full of air, threw back his head, and bellowed to the emerging stars, "Thomas Emiga, you brilliant, benevolent old son of a good woman, I love you!" There were giggles from some of the children who waited for admission, and warm smiles from some of the adults leaving along with him, but only one of the admitting attendants looked up from his work. He was new at the job.
"I'm going to find out where they've got you planted," the bearded man raved on, "and dig you up and kiss your rod on the moldy lips. You did it right, cousin."
The ticket-taker could see how it must have been. The fellow had come to Dreamworld for the first time old. Jaded and cynical, he had been told what to expect but had not believed it. He had arrived expecting to sneer. Now, only hours later, he was stunned by his own monstrous arrogance and terribly grateful to have been forgiven for it. The attendant felt nostalgia and kinship. He hoped the bearded man didn't live too far away. If his home was outside practical commuting distance to Dreamworld, the bearded man was going to have to move, the way the attendant had. He yanked his attention back to his work. His own line was starting to build, and his supervisor would be offering him help in a minute. But part of his mind remained on the bearded man, who had completed first-stage decompression and was literally skipping toward his distant car now, and so distracted, the attendant failed to note that the chubby 12-year-old before him had only one chin. He took her money, gave her her map and brochure, fastened a dream band around her thick little wrist with something less than his usual care, and passed her through the gate into Dreamworld without a second thought. He did notice that her smile of thanks was especially incandescent. He would have been somewhat puzzled to see it fade 30 seconds later as the flaw in her planning became clear to her. There were many places in Dreamworld where a child could be alone, and there were some places where she could be unobserved. But as far as the chubby girl knew, there was only one place she could be both alone and unobserved, and if she went in there, it might be too dangerous to come out again. She had not thought Phase 2 through far enough, perhaps because subconsciously she had not truly expected Phase 1 to succeed. She wandered aimlessly around the octagon, the football field-sized commons from which all 8 of the paths of Dreamworld originated, for about 10 minutes, trying to think of Plan B. The best she could do was plan A prime, go ahead as planned, and, if it came apart, improvise. Her bladder cast the deciding vote. She chose the smallest and least popular of the 8 available ladies' rooms, the one way over by the path to the bounding main, and forced herself to go in. No one paid any attention to her. She lingered by the sink, looking at nothing at all, until the stall she wanted came free, the one nearest the door with only one neighbor. Once safely locked inside it, she took off her blouse, turtleneck sweater, breasts, shoes, belly pack, and forearms. Now he was a 12-year-old boy with makeup on. He slid his dream band off the wrist of his collapsed fake forearm and put it in his right-hand pocket. He opened the belly pack, took out his own shoes and a reasonably good counterfeit dream band, stuffed everything else into the pack, and zipped it back up. The sound reminded him of his bladder. He unzipped his fly to attend to the matter. At the last possible instant, the lowered seat reminded him that girls didn't pee standing up. He was able to cut off the flow in time, but it hurt. Feeling stupid and oddly ashamed, he turned around, sat, and did his business, trying not to wonder what the napkin disposal unit was. As he flushed, he blushed, realizing he had not remembered to make any toilet paper noises first. This was tricky. Now to escape. Improvise. If he could just get as far as the door undetected, he could tell anyone who saw him emerge that his kid sister had gotten sick, and then maybe he could fade away when they went in to help. He put his belly pack back on, outside his clothes this time, and waited, listening hard to traffic sounds outside the stall. Finally, he decided there were as few girls out there as there were going to be. About 10 meters to the exit. Feats don't fail me now. He threw open the door and relaxed, seeing himself in the mirror opposite. He had forgotten about the wig and makeup. He no longer looked like the chubby, effeminate girl who had come in, but he could pass as a skinny butch girl. He ignored the 2 girls present and made boldly for the exit. The visual barrier that was meant to keep dirty old men from peering in gave him 3 strides of concealment in which to whip the wig off and wipe at his makeup with it. Rehearsing his 6 sister lines, he jammed the wig into the belly pack, opened the door, and stepped out. Absolutely no one paid the slightest bit of attention to him. Of course. In Dream World, parents did not feel they had to stand guard while their children were using the toilet. Nothing untoward could possibly happen as long as they were wearing their dream bands. That reminded him to remove the fake dream band he had fetched with him from his left-hand pocket and put it on, as unobtrusively as possible. God, he thought, I'd better steady down. 5 oafouts already. And this was supposed to be the easy part. The hard part was coming up. But of course he had to wait for Firefall. None of the rides would be running until that was over. Everything in Dream World ground to a halt every night while it was in progress, and just about everything else within a radius of 5 kilometers. People dropped whatever they were doing to watch the incredible display of pyrotechnics, lasers, holograms, and kamikaze nanobots, no matter how many times they had seen it before. You stood and stared at all that fire cascading from the sky, all those different kinds of fire, and your busy chattering monkey mind fell silent, and whatever was in your heart came bubbling to the surface. He stood with the rest, and his heart threatened to boil over. There was too much compressed within it. He could not afford that, not yet. He knew how to go to a place in his mind where nothing could reach him, but it took great effort, and that particular muscle was nearly exhausted. He did it anyway. Maybe, if the gods were kind, it would be the last time for a while. He failed to notice when Firefall ended. Where he was, fireworks were still going off. He was roused from his auto-hypnotic trance by a minor commotion near him. The way he phrased it to himself was, a disturbance in the force. He scanned the crowd around him and saw 3 smiling cousins in their lemon jumpsuits converging from afar like yellow corpuscles without apparent haste or urgency but covering ground fast. Behind them came 2 non-smiling Dreamworld employees in street clothes, backstage personnel. For a paranoid instant, he thought they were after him, but then located their target a few meters away. An adult, who had elected to watch Firefall, reclining in a chaise longue. 2 cousins were already kneeling beside her. She must have been taken ill. One of them moved, and he got his first clear look at the elderly woman's face. Just then, the lighting in the local area changed in a subtle way. Within seconds, they were all in shadow. But he had seen. He heard the nearer cousin sigh and murmur, God, look at her smile. She doesn't have to go home now, the other said softly. Ever. I wouldn't mind going like that myself when it's my time. Then she looked up and saw him. She frowned, pasted a very good smile over it, put a finger to her lips, and addressed him in a stage whisper. This poor lady's exhausted. Let's let her nap a minute, okay? He kept his face straight, nodded, and forced himself to leave the area nonchalantly as though he had bought her story. The last thing he needed was a cousin deciding he was traumatized, putting an arm around him, asking him questions for which he could no longer remember the lies he had prepared. He'd intended to dawdle for an hour or so after Firefall, going on a few of his favorite rides for the last time as a civilian. But all at once he felt he had been given a sign. Someone had died happy in Dream World. Time to finish the last detail, and then get this done. He drifted over toward the exit, picked out an attendant who looked sleepy, and tugged at his sleeve. Mister, he said, gesturing vaguely behind him, the cousin over there asked me to say he needs you for a minute. Thanks, son. As he'd hoped, the attendant bought it and started away, looking around for a mythical cousin. The genuine dream band was already in his hand. Hastily, he used the attendant's abandoned wand to deactivate it and dropped it into the bin with the rest. He had rehearsed this part many times. He was done well before the attendant stopped and glanced back for directions. I guess he changed his mind, he told the attendant. Sorry. That's all right, the man said, resuming his station. Thanks anyway. You leaving now or what? No, he said. Not for a while. Then went back inside. He stopped at the first trash can he encountered, rummaged in the belly pack for the folded-up hat and false nose, and stuffed them into his pants pockets. He zipped the pack back up, took it off, and dropped it in the trash. He felt an unexpected exhilaration as the lid swung closed. The last of the evidence was disposed of. The only remaining traces of his old life were the clothes he stood in. He was as free as a bird, or the next best thing. He took the path for the Enchanted Forest, and when he got there went straight to the Unicorn's Glade ride. As he'd expected and hoped, the line was short, almost non-existent. Less time to fidget and fret, fewer witnesses. Once they were inside and the cars were arriving, the crowd around him was so sparse that he was easily able to grab the seat he needed, the last one in the train. He pulled the safety bar up and composed his features into what he called his dweeb face. It worked. No one elected to sit with him. His heart began to pound with elation as the train eased into motion. This was going to work. The last hurdle had been passed, the last tricky part. From here it was as easy as falling off a log. And so, of course, he did just that. He picked his moment with great care, waiting until they emerged from the dark tunnel into the first lighted section, and everyone else would be most distracted by things ahead of them. He had already weaseled out from under the safety bar, put the fake dream band in his pocket, and put on his elf hat and false nose. But as he slipped over the side of his car and dashed for cover, he mistook a fake log for a real one, tried to hop up onto it, slipped off, and fell headlong.
Firefall! Reprised!
When he sat up, the train was out of sight. He was not sure whether he had lost consciousness or not, or if so, for how long. With no way of knowing how soon the next train would be through, he had to assume it would be any moment.
Get up, at least to a crouch, and put on a silly leer. Empty your eyes. It's okay to look at them. They expect that, but empty your eyes first. You are an audio-animatronic robot. Here comes the train now. Empty your eyes. Here it is. Shit, there's somebody in the front seat looking this way. Look down. Oh, shit, move. Cover up that chin. If she sees the blood, she might report you're leaking oil. Cover it with your hand while you turn that side away from her smile. Here she comes. There they go. Move! 7, 6, 5, 4. Careful, don't knock over that robot. 2. Safe. I think... He crouched down in his place of concealment behind a pseudo-boulder and balanced risks. If the girl in the car had seen his bleeding shin, damn it, it hurt now that he had time for it, she might report it, in which case he was probably screwed. How likely was it that the girl was a busybody? Well, girls often were in his experience. But she might simply assume that the blood was fake, part of the show, a wounded elf for the unicorn to heal. The audio-animatronic robot he had dodged on his way to cover, a wizened old elf, was coming toward him making faintly audible whirring sounds. That was odd. He was sure that none of the robots had an itinerary that brought them through this space. He'd been on this ride dozens of times, studying, rehearsing. Hell, perhaps this one was malfunctioning in some way that was registering on a dial somewhere in central control. Time to move on. But the robot elf stood between him and the rest of the diorama, coming closer. He backed out of its way, deeper into cover. It stopped where he had been crouching, and crouched itself. Its faint little servo sounds ceased. Its monkey-like face swiveled to track him. It winked and said, "If you leave that bloodstain out there on the set, they'll know and they won't rest until they find you." Shock might have paralyzed his limbs and tongue, but instead the reverse happened. From his hunkered crouch, he exploded into something very like a Russian saber dancer's four-limbed ha kick, and a shout grew in his stomach and raced like vomit up his throat, where he nearly choked on it because the robot, moving faster than any robot he knew, seemed to have a hand over his mouth and another behind his head to brace against. He tried to yank free, and what stopped him was not the futility of pitting his strength against that of a robot, but the sudden realization of how difficult it was not. The robot hands were strong, stronger than his own, but far less strong than they should have been. They were warm. Too many urgent inputs will cause most information systems to crash, and he had been in crummy shape to start with. He went limp. The elf caught him under the arms, gently laid him down in a spot where he would be concealed from view, and stood back up. Another train came through. He lay there, dizzily, and watched the elf mime a plausible routine for it. The soft sounds of servo mechanisms and hydraulics, the sharp sounds of clattering wheels and laughing children, and the sequentially fading series of Xerox copies that Echo made of all these, all washed over him. They very nearly overwhelmed the sound of his heart banging in his chest. "I've had my eye on you for the last week or so," the elf murmured when the train was passed, without looking at him. "I figured you were going to make your move soon. I like the way you handle yourself. You have respect, and you're not stupid." "You're human," he said softly, wonderingly. The elf grimaced. "Thanks a lot." "You're a..." He scrambled back up to a crouch. "A girl!" "Make up your mind," she said. "Am I human or not?" She sounded like an aunt or a teacher, as old as her elf persona looked and sour. But she was no taller than he was. "Oh, the hell with it. Wait here." She straightened up, making soft mechanical humming sounds again. He realized with wonder and some amusement that she was actually humming them, and walked around the boulder, out onto the set of the Unicorn's Glade and into view of its patrons. He had practiced imitating robot movements a great deal, but this person was much better. He scrambled to the edge of cover to watch her. She walked in a seemingly random pattern that led her past the spot where he had first fallen and hurt his shin. When she reached it, she improvised a move which was in character for her elf persona and which brought her down on one knee. She remained on that knee until a train had passed, slid the knee back and forth along the floor, then rose and returned to his place of concealment. The blood that had been on the floor was now almost invisible on her dark trouser leg. "Come on," she said, and continued past him. Doing his own robot walk, he followed her.
A brief between chapters intermission from The Great Moe Scarlet, again with Jeff Healey in Toronto in 2005.
So I've got a little number here that's from the 30s. It would be more of a ragtime-oriented piece, and it's this is a song about two people. A song about a marriage that actually worked out for somebody. Now, having said that, which one of the two of them it actually worked out for, you have to determine for yourself when you hear the song, I guess. And it's called Big Bad Bill, and here it goes. In the town of Louisville, there lived a man named Big Bad Bill. I want to tell you, he sure was tough. He certainly could strut that stuff. He had folks so scared to death. When he walked by, they held their breath. He was a fighting man, sure enough. Now Bill took himself a wife just to lead a different life. Big Bad Bill is Sweet William now. Married life has changed him somehow.
He's a man they all used to fear. Well, now the people call him Sweet Papa Willie Dear. Stronger than Samson, I declare. Till a hi-hat mama bob his hair. Big Bad Bill don't fight anymore. He washes dishes and he mops up the floor. He used to spend his evenings looking for a fight, and now he's got to see his mama every night. Big Bad Bill is Sweet William now. Met him too. Yeah, Big Bad Bill is Sweet William now. Well, married life has changed him somehow. He's a man they all used to fear. Well, now the people call him Sweet Papa Willie Dear. Stronger than Samson, I declare. Till the hi-hat mama bobbed his hair. A Big Bad Bill don't fight anymore. Washes dishes and he mops up the floor. Even threatened to do it with me one time.
Oh my.
Used to spend his evenings looking for a fight, and now he's got to see his mama every night. Yes, a Big Bad Bill is sweet. Whoa, a Big Bad Bill is so sweet. A Big Bad Bill is Sweet William now.
Big Bad Bill, thank you.
Now here's another taste of the free lunch. Chapter 2, Under. And she walked straight into a boulder and vanished. He followed without hesitation, not because he grasped that the boulder was a hologram, but simply because he was in shock. When he passed through it himself, things changed too fast for him to integrate. Nearly at once he encountered another wall, and his knees and face proved that this one was not a hologram. He rebounded, his vision dithering, and would have gone down again if she had not caught him. Both her grip and her arms were too strong for someone her size. She smells like a robot, he thought, like machine oil. Always turn right, she murmured in his ear. Huh? She stood him on his feet, released him, and stepped back. In dream world, if you walk through something you thought was there, always turn right. It's a rule of thumb. She pointed. Sure enough, the concealed corridor they were in now debouched to their right. He filed the information and studied her. She was exactly his own height, which was not impressive even for a 12-year-old, but she was unquestionably an adult. Face and voice confirmed it, as did body language now that she was no longer imitating a robot. She was a midget. Not a dwarf, but a perfectly proportioned small person, with powerful arms and hands. Her wrinkled features, the smoky rasp in her voice, and the great dignity with which she carried herself made him think of a maiden aunt or a school principal, but somehow she would not have fitted into either pigeonhole even if she were not dressed as a robot elf. She was old enough and certainly sour enough, but she wasn't sad enough. She's not lonely, he thought, and wondered how he could know such a thing about her. My fault, she went on. I should have caught you as you came through. I assumed if you got this far, you knew that much. This is only the third time I've been all the way backstage, he said, and I got caught right away the other times, like under a minute. You're getting better, she said. This was a good place. You'd have made it if you hadn't fallen. This far, at least. Yeah, I guess. He inspected his shin. Thanks, he added belatedly, realizing he had been complimented. Who are you? Annie. Hi, Annie. Don't say, it's unbecoming. I have an excuse to grunt, you don't. Huh? And huh is even worse. He was not prepared to debate diction. He reached and came up with perhaps the only thing left in the world that he was reasonably certain of. I'm Mike. Hello, Mike. Welcome to Dreamworld Under. He caught himself. Sorry. Thanks, Annie. Am I really here? I mean, are we safe now? She shrugged. Probably safer than most of the people on this weary planet, boy. Relax. They can't see in here, they can't hear in here, they can't smell in here unless I want them to, and they don't even know that. And the next inspection team isn't due through this area for weeks unless something glitches. The knot of muscle at the base of his neck relaxed just barely enough for him to notice. Good. Thanks, Annie. I hope I didn't... don't mention it. Especially not to anybody else. So what's... She stopped, frowned at something, and rephrased. How long were you thinking of staying in Dreamworld? Well, he began so he wouldn't say, and used the tiny interval to think hard about the question. It was one he had been postponing himself for some time now, and he knew she had not asked it casually. As long as I can, he said finally. Something in her serene face changed. For an instant, he thought he might have offended her, or perhaps saddened her somehow, but then she said, good answer. She closed her eyes for a few seconds. Okay, she said, opening them again. You seem lucky, and clever, and reasonably polite. Here's how it will be. I will help you, but neither of us is ever going to ask the other why they came here. Ever. Is that acceptable to you? Okay, he said simply. Here's your end of the bargain, she said. You have to listen to me. He nodded. Don't look so dismayed. I don't mean you have to hang a patient look on your face while I blather about my youth, for God's sake. I mean you have to pay attention when I tell you things. Talking is very hard work for me. I hardly ever do it. And if I have to tell you things twice, you're going to make some stupid blunder and get at least one of us busted out of here. I warn you, if it's me, this place is going to turn on you. He digested that. How long have you been here, Annie? Under, you mean? What year is it? 23, he said, beginning to be awed. July something, 2023. 13 years, then. She turned on her heel and walked away. Mike knew he must follow her, and still he stood frozen a moment in shock. Dreamworld was only a little over 13 years old. He snapped out of it and raced after her. It was a little like learning that one unicorn exists. It changed everything. Mike felt like a biochemist who has labored for years to synthesize a wonderful new drug, then learns Aborigine herb doctors have known about that one for centuries. As they moved behind the scenes of Dreamworld, he tried to pay attention to his surroundings, but had trouble keeping his mind on the task. His eyes kept being drawn to his guide, his hero, now that he knew she existed. Mike's hopeless, desperate, quixotic quest was actually possible. Someone had done it. This unprepossessing midget auntie before him had done it, had been doing it for longer than he had been alive. No wonder she wasn't lonely. She had the unicorn, the warlock, Wesleyan Buttercup, the mother thing, the hippogriff, Wanda the Weirpoodle, Captain Horatio and his crew, Master Lee and Number 10 Ox, Mike Callahan and his friends, Moondog Johnny, Lummox and John Thomas, and all the countless elves and trolls and leprechauns and dwarves for her constant companions. No wonder she looked so serene. For longer than his own lifetime, she had been living not just in A, but in the dream world. No wonder she accepted him.
they were kindred spirits in a world of clones. He studied her with intense fascination. So that was how she walked when she wasn't imitating a robot. It suddenly came to him that he had absolutely no idea how they had gotten from where they started to where they were now, which was halfway down a long tubular shaft with a ladder on one side. There were the rumbling sounds of a ride somewhere nearby, but he could neither locate its direction nor identify it, save that it seemed to be moving too fast to be any part of the unicorn's glade. He glanced up, and the shaft appeared simply to end about 50 meters higher up. No access hatch was visible. He glanced down and saw only that he was lagging behind. When he reached the bottom of the ladder, Annie stood aside and made room for him to step down onto the metal floor. She gestured at a keypad on the wall. "Do what I did up there," she said. "I didn't see it," he confessed, reddening in shame. She clouded up. "I told you not to make me repeat myself. What the hell were you looking at?" "You," he said miserably. She closed her eyes. "Oh, my stars and garters! God has punished my contempt for authority." She sighed and reopened her eyes. "At least have the wit to pay particular attention to my hands, then. I do most of my best work with them." "Yes, Annie." With insultingly exaggerated pantomime, she addressed the keypad and punched in a 4-digit number. A door silently dilated next to the keypad.
"Got it this time?"
"How do you know what number to use?" he asked.
"From this."
She held up her left wrist to display a command band, like those worn by Dreamworld's employees. It resembled a guest's dream band, with pop-up monitor and keypad added. She hadn't been wearing it during her stint as an elf. She must have slipped it on while he wasn't looking. "It also makes me invisible to 3 different surveillance systems, and you too, as long as you stay within 3 meters of me." She hit clear on the keypad, and the door winked shut again. 713-9614-3.1415-1175, she chanted in a rapid monotone and stood aside. "Now you try it." He went to the keypad, punched 4 digits, and the door reappeared. "Better," she said curtly, and shouldered him aside to step through. At that moment he realized suddenly that he was ravenously hungry. He decided not to mention it and followed her. He'd been hungry before. He'd never been under in Dreamworld before. They passed through a series of environments in rapid succession. Each time she let him key in the code that admitted them to the next. Some he could identify, at least tentatively, as air circulation tunnels, engine rooms, repair shops, switching nodes, degaussing zones, and the like. Some were so unfamiliar he could not even guess their nature or function. Some were noisy, some as silent as a stone. All were well lit and clean. As he doggedly memorized the route, he mentally labeled such regions things like "place where it smells funny," or "room with no room," or "inside the dentist's drill." He had the general impression that Annie and he were gradually descending below ground. At one point they heard approaching voices and footsteps, and she led him immediately and unerringly to the nearest good hiding place where they waited together until the danger was past. A little while later she stopped short again. Mike looked around for another hidey-hole, but instead of hiding, she went to a nearby machine, a big, complex thing he could not identify. She stared at it, sniffed it, reached into it and made some adjustment, then bent and put her ear up against the side of it and listened. After several seconds had elapsed, she frowned and straightened. Taking a red marker from a pocket, she wrote something on the wall above the machine. A single rune, which Mike didn't recognize. It looked a little like the classical symbol for male, but was subtly different. Without explanation, she put away the marker, and they continued on their way. At the end of a long, featureless lime-green corridor, they came to another keypad, and he automatically began to enter the access code. She stopped him with an upraised hand. "This time," she said, "punch in the date of opening day." He blinked. "The whole thing?" "If you know it," she agreed. He punched in the 6 digits of the date on which Thomas Emiga had opened the gates of his mighty dream for the first time 13 years earlier. At once he heard the familiar, barely audible sound of a door dilating, but no doorway appeared where he was expecting it. He decided the sound might have come from off to one side, though he wasn't sure which, and glanced quickly in both directions. Still no door. But he had not heard it sigh shut again yet, or had he only imagined hearing it in the first place? He looked at Annie, She was trying not to smile. It made him mad. He closed his eyes, thought furiously, then turned on his heel and walked directly into the left wall of the corridor. As he passed through it, he was already turning right. He was in a small room. Before him was a door, a real old-fashioned door with hinges and a knob, and in front of it lay a welcome mat. He stopped and waited for Annie to catch up. She came through the hologram wall, still trying not to smile, but having trouble with it. "Not bad. How did you know which direction to go in, back in the corridor?" "You said always turn right when you go through a hollow. If it was in the other wall, you'd have to turn left whenever you left home." "How old are you?" "How old are you?" Her rebel smile disappeared. She blinked. "Point taken. I beg your pardon and withdraw the question." She sighed, pointed her wristband at the door, and the door beeped softly. "Well, are we going to stand out here all night, or do you want supper?" He allowed himself to become aware of the black hole at his center and nearly fainted with sudden hunger. He turned and opened the door, stopped and wiped his feet on the mat, stepped through and turned to see her staring at him oddly. "What?" he demanded. "This might just work," she said. "Isn't that hilarious?" He suddenly started to see the whole situation from her point of view. He began to giggle. To his astonishment, she joined him. She had not, until now, seemed to be the sort of person who giggled. It struck him funny. Before he knew it, all his anger and most of his tension were boiling out of him as laughter. It felt oddly like throwing up. Then his vision started doing special effects. First solarization, then color shimmer, and finally dissolve to random, vibrant pixels. Nearly at once it resolved again. Annie's face was a few decimeters from his, taut with concern. "Don't try to get up." "Okay," he said agreeably. He hadn't realized he was down. He felt himself picked up and carried. He marveled at her strength. He was pretty sure he could not have carried someone his own size. She set him gently on what he could tell was a bed. He tried to tow his shoes off, but found it oddly hard to do. "I'll get it," she said, and did. "Sleep now. You can eat later." "Okay," he said again, and did as he was told. The moment of awakening can be as hard to pin down as the instant love dies. Mike's first conscious thought was that there was a spoon in his mouth. Investigating, he found his favorite food in all the universe, Captain Horatio's clam chowder, at the business end of it, and Annie on the other. He swallowed. His belly told him it was at least his third or fourth spoonful of soup. It made him think of how Mom always said he would sleep through his own hanging, and that made him want to stop thinking, so he did, and ate soup. By the time the bowl was empty, he had become aware of his surroundings. His first reaction to Annie's home was surprise at how unsurprising it was. Heck, it was downright boring. It reminded him of a hotel room, a cheap hotel room, the only kind he had ever seen except in TV or films. No entertainment center, in fact, no visible TV or stereo of any kind. No posters, paintings, or pictures. No windows, hardly any furniture at all, really, and all of that looked old and dinky. The computer was so old it had no speakers. Looking closer, he saw its disk drive would accept only Stone Age floppy disks, and its monitor could not be changed in either size or aspect ratio. The bed he lay on was antique, unpowered, simply a flat rectangle. He sat upright only with the aid of a precarious pyramid of pillows. The single visible recreational amenity was a pair of bookshelves packed full with books, mostly beat-up paperbacks. Something else nagged at his subconscious and then surfaced. There was no remote control of any kind within reach of the bed. Then all at once it made sense. He asked himself two questions. Why did I have an HEC and posters and a good PC and a real bed in my room when I still had all that stuff? And why do most people? And the answer to both came back the same. So we won't mind so much that we don't live in dream world. Annie didn't need any of that stuff. Besides, she'd have to be prepared to abandon everything she owned if security ever got wind of her and she had to jungle up someplace else. So why own anything much? "You can go back to sleep again if you like," she said, setting down the empty bowl. "It's the middle of the night." She wore a dark purple silk robe and slippers. He realized suddenly that he was naked under the covers, but could not manage to work up any embarrassment over it. He had been a patient before. He made himself take a deep breath. "How many of us are there?" he asked. She blinked. Two. How many does it look like? I mean, under. The answer is still the same. We're the whole club, boy. You and I are the only ones P-W-O-L. Huh? I mean, beg pardon? Present without official leave. Am I coming through? No one else is under. Oh. Dozens have tried. Well, hundreds have tried. Maybe thousands for all I know, but dozens have gotten as far as you have. As of today, nobody but me has been under for as long as a week. The current record is 4.5 days. Oh. He felt sharp dismay. I didn't help any of them, she said. None of them even knew I was here. He started to answer, but the longer he hesitated, the longer he hesitated. Annie must know his obvious next question. Since she wasn't going ahead and answering it, she must not want to. What did he do wrong? He asked finally. Who? Oh, you mean the record holder? Yeah. He pissed me off. From her, the expression was startling. Then the meaning sank in. I got him kicked out, she agreed. I locked a door behind him one day. He didn't belong here. Oh, don't look so worried. He started to relax. I belong here, then? I don't know yet, she said impersonally. But we've been introduced. If I ever decide you don't belong, I'll tell you first. Oh, don't look so worried, I said. Damn it, boy, you've gotten farther than almost anyone else in the history of Dreamworld. Be content with that for now. Except for you, he couldn't help adding. She looked amused. I am the history of Dreamworld. Have you ever... He hesitated. Do you ever go, you know, out? Never, and I don't plan to. There was flat finality in her voice. She got up and brought the empty bowl to the small sink at one end of the room, rinsed it, and set it aside to dry. More soup here, she said, pointing at the microwave. Fridge there, pantry there, dunny over there, behind that door. If you want anything, help yourself. I'm going to bed. She came back to the bedside and, to his astonishment, dropped her robe, climbed in beside him, and slid under the covers. Don't bother trying to explore. I've locked us in. Mike rummaged through his entire social experience in search of an appropriate comment to make to an adult female stranger who has just joined one in bed and came up empty. By the time he came up with "Good night" as a default choice, he was talking to himself. That was Chapter 2 of The Free Lunch by Spider Robinson, coming soon from Blackstone Audiobooks. By the way, as far as I'm concerned, now and forever, Annie is the brilliant Oscar-winning actor Linda Hunt. She's who I saw in my mind's eye as I was writing the book. As far as I know, I've never succeeded in getting a copy of the book into her hands, so if you happen to know anyone who might know her, please pass the word that she is literally my hero. Now it's time to fold this tent, but before I go, as you may know if you've been following my daughter's awesome blog at www.gracefulwomanwarrior.com, on September 13th my Terry will undergo surgery in New York City. Please hold her in your prayers or thoughts on that day. On the 20th I'll fly to New York to help her husband Heron drive her and my 3-year-old granddaughter Marissa home to Ohio, and I'll stay there with them for at least a month, indulging myself in a feast of blissful grandpappery while Terry heals up. I should be home on my island by early November, and with luck I'll get another podcast up in time for Christmas. Meantime, I continue to work hard on my novel Orphan Stars. Progress is painfully slow, but the ideas have finally started flowing again, and I shall persevere. Thank you one more time for your ongoing support. It helps more than I know how to say. Now, Moe Scarlett is going to take us home, this time with the late Jackie Washington and Ken Whiteley from a CD of theirs you can find at cdbaby.com. And by the way, that testimonial was unsolicited, not disguised advertising. From the Scarlett, Washington, and Whiteley CD, Sitting on a Rainbow, here's a song with music by Duke Ellington and Barney Bigard, with lyrics by Irving Mills, the classic mood indigo. See you next time. Bye.
had that mood, indigo. That feeling goes from your head to your toes. Indigo, since my baby said goodbye. In the evening when the lights are low, people, I'm so lonesome I could cry. Now there's nobody who cares about me. Oh, as a man can be. Always get that blue indigo. People, I could lay me down and die. You ain't been blue. No.
As always, this episode of Spider on the Web and its contents are licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 3.0 United States license. See you next time.